Today in Studio 360, we are talking about being alone, its creative pleasures, and its hazards. Joining me is the writer Jonathan Lethem. He got big acclaim a few years ago for his novel Motherless Brooklyn, and his most recent novel is called The Fortress of Solitude, about a boy growing up as almost the only white kid on his block in 1970s Brooklyn. He's got a brand new collection of essays out right now. And Jonathan Lethem, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Now, you called your most recent novel The Fortress of Solitude after Superman's hideout up near the North Pole.
Yeah.
How come?
Well, I always was sort of fascinated and amused by the idea of the Fortress of Solitude, because here's Superman, who's the sort of the most popular guy in the world, and he needs this place up in the Arctic to go and sort of lick his wounds and brood and walk the hallways of this giant empty fortress and talk to himself, which is what he does up there. And the fact that even Superman kind of needed to sulk a lot and needed to have this special place to go and do it struck me as revealing of something incredibly petulant and I guess self-pitying in the image of the superhero and of course the image of the teenager who adores a superhero.
Well, that's it, isn't it? And as you were just speaking, I realized that as a kid, as a DC Comics kid, a Superman lover, I love the Fortress of Solitude episodes. And I guess that, again, speaks to the kind of pre-adolescent and adolescent sensibility that goes for both of those.
Well, spins. You know, Superman even has a collection of statues of his friends in the Fortress of Solitude. So he's got a sort of a statue of Lois Lane and a statue of Jimmy Olsen, and he goes and he kind of gazes at them and talks to them as though that's better than being with, you know, the real Jimmy Olsen, who's down in Metropolis, you know, anytime Superman would care to spend time with him.
Now, your novel, Fortress of Solitude, seems autobiographical. How was your life as a boy like or different than the hero, your hero Dylan's?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you ask that question in this framework of solitude, because the biggest differences across the board are that I increase the isolation of the character. You know, he's a single son of being raised by a single father. I was actually, you know, I grew up in a family with siblings, and I had a mom much later into my childhood than the main character of the book. So I've reduced his options for contact.
I would love it if you'd read a little bit of The Fortress of Solitude for us.
Sure. Here goes. The week after Halloween had a quality both hungover and ominous. The light pitched. The sky smashed against the rooftops. November. Go deep, Henry commanded. Now he wagged a football, the latest enticement. Four kids were like yo-yos strung to his hand, running to jump in a cluster when he finally spiraled the football half the length of the block. No matter what happened, whichever hands the ball came down in or eluded, Henry's expression was sour. There was something inelegant or compromised in the ball's descent from the air where he'd placed it. Dylan Ebdus waited on Henry's stoop in a bubble of silence, seeing he made six, wondering if they'd call him into the street to even the sides for a game. He detected in himself a certain translucency today, a talent for being ignored. Rachel had flushed him from a four-day hide in his room, from a retrenchment into the secret power of his books and pencils, into the mysteries of eavesdropping on Abraham's footfalls and Rachel's clangor on the telephone, into the dreary conundrums of the Etch-a-Sketch and the Spirograph. And something in his conjured solitude had followed him out onto the street, then reversed itself to drape all over him anywhere he sat still. Gaze long enough into Dean Street, and Dean Street will gaze into you.
That's Jonathan Lethem reading from his novel, The Fortress of Solitude, which is our subject today in Studio 360, Solitude. As you say, Dylan lost his mother as a, I think, 10-year-old in your book. You lost your mother much later. Did that, however, become a kind of the transformative event of your young adulthood?
Well, you know, I've written about loss over and over again. My first few novels all center around some enormous missing piece, whether it's language or you know, there's a kind of amnesiac loss of memory that's a condition that the characters suffer. And as I worked on my fourth and fifth novels, I realized I was moving closer and closer to writing about a personal condition of losing a parent. But I'm not sorry in a way that I circled around that main subject for so long, because I think what matters to me about my own loss, paradoxically, is that it's connected to universal feelings of, you know, disconnection or suffering, and that in a funny way, I was handed this enormous subject matter.
Uh-huh.
My mother died of cancer slowly while I was turning 11, 12, 13, and 14 when she finally died, same year I began high school. But in some way, I think experiencing that loss only increased a pre-existing feeling for a condition of having lost something. Growing up in New York in the 1970s, I was very sensitive to the feeling that the world itself had suffered some kind of fundamental displacement or loss. New York City itself seemed like a kind of dystopian city. My parents, who were radicals, had grown up protesting in the civil rights era and then protesting the Vietnam War. And even though both of those battles had been won in some sense, there was something in the mid-70s that felt very much like a kind of loss of possibilities mm-hmm. for the counterculture. And I was so sensitive to this idea that great things fell apart that I think when my own family fell apart because of my mother's illness and then death, it seemed to me only the natural course of things.